Welcome to the program. Today, we'll be continuing with our ongoing in-depth series on abuses in psychiatry. We're going to look at natural and non-toxic alternatives to many of the conditions that people are told they have. We're going to speak with a person who has a project called Safe Harbor, designed to provide choices to people interested in alternative healing methods for mental disturbances. And then we're going to talk with Margot Kidder. You may remember her from some of her 55 films, including the Superman series. I'm sure that the last thing you heard about her was probably some negative statements about her mental condition in the newspapers. This is the other side of the story. Before we go there today, I'll bring you up on some of the latest issues in this area. For example, there's a new book coming out, and the book is called Orthorexia Nervosa, Overcoming the Obsession with Eating Healthy. And it's published by Broadway Books. In fact, my own publishing company, or a company I publish with, in fact, whom I bestsellers have been with Broadway. And I'll just read something here. One of the reviews by Adriana Berman, medical doctor. Health Food Junkies is a smart, funny, insightful expose of a new eating disorder that the author calls orthorexia nervosa. The term is a combination of ortho, meaning straight or correct, and orex, appetite, reminiscent of anorexia nervosa. The disorder is characterized by obsessive attention to food quality or by food cultism. And the book describes a progression from the genesis of orthorexia, from a desire to improve health and treat illness or lose weight through the spiritual compensations of enduring a strict diet. And it writes, quote, the author, a day filled with wheatgrass juice, tofu, and quinoa biscuits may come to feel as holy as one's been serving the destitute and homeless. And then within this, they say the orexics have a grim sense of self-righteousness that begins to consume all their sources of joy and meaning, unquote. Isn't it interesting that now they have gone almost full circle? The very conditions that will contribute to mental decline and confusion, mental fatigue, and aberrant behaviors, from anxiety and psychotic, neurotic behaviors to depression and mania, meaning chemical imbalances in our food, nutrient deficiencies, hyperstimulation of the brain by artificial sweeteners, food allergies such as dairy, sugar, yeast, meat, pesticides, MSG, all of these have been shown to contribute to excitotoxic or altered states of brain behavior. So when people finally wake up to this and say, gee whiz, there's a cause and effect. When I eat this way, I feel better. When I eat this way, I feel worse. When I feel worse, I'm told that it's irreversible genetic and I should take a tranquilizer or neuroleptic or electroconvulsive therapy. If I eat this way, it doesn't come back and my overall health and vitality improved. Now we're telling, this is what this author is saying, and you can bet they're going to get a lot of publicity on this, that the very act of wanting to be healthy and taking the time and effort and commitment to do so is itself a mental disease. So now we have no place to go, do we? No matter what we do, it can now be pathologized and profited. How interesting. Last evening, I was filming the final meeting of a health support group. The room was packed. One at a time, people got up for the opportunity to simply share with our group what changes had occurred in their life. I heard a middle-aged Haitian gentleman who never says anything in class talk about a very advanced prostate enlargement, high PSA, brought back to normal. Congestive heart failure, brought back to normal. Diabetes, gone. Arthritis, gone. Fibromyalgia, gone. I heard people talk about fibrocystic breasts, gone. Depression, gone. An 8-year bout of depression on 2 different antidepressant drugs, no longer on the drugs, completely normal emotions. One person after another, best exemplified by a French woman who got up to talk about not just what changed physically, but what changed emotionally. How much joy there is each day in waking up. How much more positive life is. How much more tolerant and accepting. How much more non-judgmental she is. Being able to listen without reacting. Being able to go to emotional and neutral places before you attack or condemn or reject something or someone. Being able to see that we have put an inordinate amount of time into our obsession and little or any time into reflection. Being able to sit now and appreciate nature in all of its manifestation. Interesting that this person who has gone through at the age of 50, as she said, the most important changes in her life in a positive sense, and feels very optimistic about the future. She no longer fears aging or loneliness. She's looking for the great sense of joy, what tomorrow is going to bring. She now would be described as having this new made-up term because of her interest. Now, if she stayed sick, compulsive, depressed, angry, if she kept her anger in or threw it out, if she took tranquilizers or antipsychotic medication, if she took electroconvulsive therapy, then all these authority figures would say, she's just fine. She'll have to stay this way the rest of her life. She'll have to take these drugs forever. No one ever gets off of them. There's no cures within orthodox psychiatry, or psychology for that matter. But it's good that she knows her place, and we know her place. We've defined it. She has a label. She is in our cookbook. She's one of the recipes. It's amazing how, just when you think that the public has awakened from this stupor and seen it, what impacts upon it, the effort to make themselves well is now considered a disease. That's just the beginning of it. Let's go on. And by the way, I will do all I can at every point in this author's journey to offer challenges. Because I have the same publisher, I will offer to debate him. I'll first invite the author on my show, giving absolute opportunity to present his ideas, and then I will offer my challenges. This comes from Kelly Patricia O'Meara and from Insight Magazine. I'll quote it. The recent wave of school shooting incidents has some concerned parents demanding that the medical records of students taking psychotropic drugs be made public. In the last 10 shooting incidents at schools, a total of 105 students, teachers, and administrators were killed or wounded. Beginning in March 1998 with a shooting at Westside Middle School in Jonesboro, Arkansas, and ending with the March 22, 2001 shooting at Granite Hills High School in Elkhagen, California, 6 of the 12 juvenile shooters are reported to have been on prescription mind-altering drugs. San Diego Deputy Public Defender William Traynor announced last week that his client, 18-year-old Jason Hoffman, who is charged with the shooting of 5 students and teachers at Granite Hills High School, had been prescribed the antidepressants Celexa and Effexor. Whether Traynor intends to use this medical information as part of his client's defense is unclear, though he said that, quote, the drugs Hoffman was prescribed may help explain his actions, unquote. He adds that research, quote, indicates that the drugs that were prescribed are extremely powerful antidepressants with the most dangerous side effects, unquote. According to Lauren Mosher, professor of psychiatry at the University of California, San Diego, quote, Celexa and Effexor are selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors in a class with Prozac, Paxil, and Luvox, unquote. The same drug prescribed to Columbine shooter Eric Harris. It appears Traynor believes there is a correlation between the drugs and the shootings. Although he could not provide specific information about his client, he tells this magazine that this is a hot-button issue and there are many people who don't want to look at the connection. If you say those drugs aren't maybe involved, you'll be labeled a kook. But with the history of these drugs, there's a huge unpredictability factor. When someone goes off while on these drugs, it should raise some eyebrows in the community. I'm starting to wonder when the public has the right to this information. What is the balance of rights? It's his medical records versus the public right to be safe. Which one has the trump card? It's a legitimate question. Although Traynor is not the only public official to consider the possibility that widely prescribed mind-altering drugs may play a role in much publicized school violence, he is among the few to make public the issue of medical records generally being protected and put off limits. The privacy of medical records, including mental health information, is protected by law. The information about the prescription drug history of an accused perpetrator is only made public when the information is released by the family or school officials, friends, and sometimes law enforcement officials or attorneys. And of course, such information seems to be of interest to the public only in the wave of concern after a violent event, making it difficult even to consider whether prescribed psychotropic drugs are a chronic cause of other widespread senseless violence. And it goes on to talk about how many other individuals end up committing violence on these drugs. Now, just as an aside, and I'm sure that Kelly O'Meara was not aware of this, but I am developing now a database going back 20 years of all the different people been committing crimes, and I'm trying to tap into some data systems to get not just mass killers, school shooters, but also people committing violence, domestic violence. How many of those domestic violent cases or child violent cases were the people on medications, psychiatric medications? I think that's far more important and a far larger issue that must be addressed. After all, the percentage of people being beaten, screamed at, yelled at, smacked, hit, kicked, cursed each day dwarfs those who are being shot at in a school or some other place. And those run into the millions of cases. So what's the connection? Is there a connection? That's what I'm working on. I don't have it all done, don't have all the facts. I'll wait and let the facts dictate the end results of this. But I am working on this at this moment. Let's go to our guest. Oh, and by the way, if you don't think money's behind all this, if you don't think that the pharmaceutical industry is fully aware of whose pockets they have to stuff cash into and whose interests they have to be lobbied with, then listen to this. This is the World Bank's mental health plans. And this comes from Don Weitz of Science Online. And it talks about a summary, and it's a summary of the major points in the World Bank's, quote, mental health template, unquote, and the objectives, quote, to harmonize mental health policies across nations so that the same consortiums can control drug distribution and trade in these drugs freely across free trade zones. Two, make sure the government spend as little as possible on mental health care. Three, use demeaning but standardized assessments to apply labels to people. It should be easier to finger some of the anti-globalization anarchists this way, since they are obviously sociopaths. Once labels are applied, drugging and coercion are not far behind. Four, guide national mental health policies in the directions of the World Bank would like to see, i.e., more for-profit care, managed care, rationalizations of services, and forced drugging. If institutionalization must occur, it should occur in private for-profit institutions like nursing homes or boarding care homes, or in the case of institutions like the Home for Special Needs, or at least non-profit hospitals which are willing to give management contracts out to for-profit operations. So it looks like there is a balance between for-profit and not-for-profit, but there aren't. Number five, set up pro-corporate, pro-private enterprise, and pro-drug psychiatrist and private and public service providers whose CEOs can be easily bought off to implement the draconian objectives stated above and use their considerable clout and political donations to influence mental health policy development in all the right directions. Is that plain enough English? And then it goes on to deal with some of them. So clearly, this is one of the things that they're doing. The World Bank's getting into the very lucrative mental health care business because there's just so many people that you can say today are mentally imbalanced. Oh, and if they try to tell you that, well, their care, their psychiatric and psychological care really provides a better quality of life. Read this from Boston Globe, Larry Tye. Mental illness is disabling enough when it happens alone, but it almost never does. Psychological conditions are typically accompanied by an array of other medical problems, from diabetes to ulcers. The link has been noticed for generations, but only recently have researchers begun to zero in on the connection. Last month, scientists published compelling evidence that major depression triples the chance of cardiac death, and even minor depression increases the risk by more than half. Another study showed that people with major mental illness can expect to die 9 years earlier than they would otherwise. And this was published in a mainstream journal. So the very fact that a person's been labeled as mentally ill, they're going to die sooner. Now here's the interesting part. No one is looking at what the treatment does, the drugs, the shock therapy, the isolation, the restraints, the psychological impact of being labeled on the person's health and longevity. The assumption here is that if you're mentally ill, the mental illness is causing you to die sooner. That is not correct, because every one of the drugs I can show you connections to major disease. Now, this is something I think is of interest, and we're going to go to our guest right after this. This comes from God Suffers Mood Disorder, New Haven, Connecticut. In a diagnosis, it helps explain the confusing and contradictory aspects of the cosmos that have baffled philosophers, theologians, and other students of the human condition for the millennia. God, creator of the universe and longtime deity of 2 billion of followers, was found Monday to suffer from bipolar disorder. Reverend Dr. J. Henry Jurgens, a practicing psychiatrist and doctor of divinity at Yale University Divinity School, announced the historic diagnosis at a press conference. Quote, "I always knew there had to be some explanation," Jurgens said, "and after several years of patient research and long sessions with God Almighty, through the intercession medium of prayer, I was able to pinpoint the specific nature of his problem," unquote. Bipolar or manic depressive disorder is a condition that afflicts millions, characterized by cycles of elation followed by bouts of profound depression and despair. The disorder can wreak havoc on both the sufferer and his or her loved ones, particularly if it goes undetected and untreated for an extended period. Though the condition is estimated to affect one in form in or another 5% of the entire world population, Monday marks the first time it has been diagnosed in a major deity. Evidence of God's manic depression can be found throughout the universe, from the white-hot explosiveness of quasars to the cold, lifeless vacuum of space. However, theologians note, humanity's exposure to God's afflictions comes primarily through his confusing propensity to alternately reward and punish his creations with little rhyme nor reason. Last week, I lost my dear husband, Walter, to the flood, said housewife and devout churchgoer Elaine of Davenport, Iowa. I asked myself, why? Why would God do something like this, especially when he had just helped Walter overcome a long battle with colon cancer, and we were so happy that we finally had a chance to start our lives anew? New York attorney involved also gained firsthand knowledge of God's wild mood swings. Last Saturday, attorney said, on a gorgeous spring afternoon, I was jogging in Center Park with my daughter. We were marveling at the beauty and majesty of nature, and I remember thinking what a wonderful world we live in. Then, out of nowhere, I hear gunfire. Speaking from a hospital bed at Columbia Presbyterian, all they took was a measly $17, and for that, the doctors say my daughter will never walk again. If only our Holy Father didn't have those mental problems, my precious Katie might not be confined to a wheelchair for the rest of her life. Jurgen stressed that God's earthly subjects need to understand that because of his bipolar condition, he's not in control of his actions and does not realize how they affect others. Quote, what he needs from us is understanding and patience, unquote, Jurgen said. Quote, to paraphrase the words of the Lord God himself, quote, humans forgive him, for he knows not what he does, unquote. And while such drugs as Paxil, Prozac, and Zoloft have proven effective in the treatment of bipolar disorder among humans, there's no modern earthly medicine that can be prescribed for a deity as vast and complex as God. Jurgens is in the process of forming a support group, living with a bipolar creator deity, for all of humanity to, quote, get together and discuss their feelings about living in a universe run by an omnipresent loved one, not fully in control of his emotions, unquote. Jurgen said he believes God's essential condition is seasonal, as evidenced by the burst of energy and elation associated with springtime and summer, followed by the decay and bleak despair of fall and winter. Sometimes, however, the condition cycles even faster. The average person with bipolar disorder may go through as many as 10 or 12 cycles of mania and subsequent depression in a lifetime. In severe cases, the sufferer may experience 4 more a year, which is known as rapid cycling. Jurgen says, quote, we believe God suffers from even rare ultra-rapid cycling, which would account for the many documented cases in which he alternates between benevolence and rage towards humanity within a matter of seconds. For example, last week, he brought desperately needed life-giving rain to southeastern Malay while simultaneously leveling Turkey with a devastating earthquake. Further evidence of God's manic depression can be found in the Bible, in which the erotomania, the Song of Songs, sharply contrasts with the sadness and existential despair of the book of Ecclesiastes. The book of Job, Jurgen's notes, marks the best example of his condition. The book begins with the bleak lamentations of Job and ends with a full-blown manic episode by God, complete with such classic bipolar symptoms as the illusion of omnipotence and delusions of grandeur. One of the major heresies of Christian history is the Gnostic belief that the creator or demiurge is this troubled world, is a blind, idiot God who is insane. But Jurgen says this idea surfaces in many religious traditions around the globe. As it turns out, they were only half right. God has his problems like anyone else, but he is essentially trying his best. He just has a condition that makes his emotions fly out of control at times. Unquote. Well, let's go over and say hello to my first guest. How you doing, Dan Stranford?
Very well, thank you.
Now, you didn't know that about God, did you?
Boy, that was very informative. They left that out when I was going to church as a boy.
If only, think of the size of the tranquilizer we'd have to create.
Absolutely, but think of the money that we could make.
Yeah, put it on top of the biggest tower. Well, let me tell people a little bit about you. Dan Stranford is the founder of Safe Harbor, a nonprofit corporation designed to provide choices to people interested in alternative healing methods for individuals suffering from mental disturbances. And Dan, a driving force behind your creating this organization was your experience with your father, who, when you were a young boy, was diagnosed as having a nervous breakdown and was consequently given electroshock treatment and potent drugs. What type of changes did your father undergo, and what made you believe that they were due to the treatment he was getting?
Well, the changes he went were just very dramatic. My father was a lively man, very a bubbly personality and friendly, outgoing. Used to tell us these wonderful bedtime stories, doing all the funny voices and all that sort of thing. And he just didn't come home one day. And I found out later, it was probably what triggered it really was some domestic violence in the home. You know, he lost his temper and that sort of thing. And when he came home from the hospital, he had a series of shock treatments and heavy drugs. Probably, my guess is it was probably Thorazine, something like that at the time, 1958. When he came home, he was just a vacant man. In fact, I have never seen my father since. My father's still alive. I have never seen that man who I knew before these shock treatments. He looked to be in pain. He was confused. He sat there, would sit on the bed, you know, with his sort of in a bit of a confusion, you know. And I remember asking him to tell me a bedtime story after he came home from the hospital. And he just looked at me in confusion and said, I don't know any. And this has plagued him. He's now 76, and he still complains about the effects of the shock treatments. We were finally, he was on psychiatric drugs for 42 years. And late last year, we were able to get him off of antipsychotics completely using nutrient therapy.
Hmm. You have 3 years of experience working in the psychiatric ward of a hospital. How often did you see patients improve under the care of the practitioners there?
You know, that's an interesting question. I actually, in 3 years of working there, I actually saw one person recover. I saw other people walk out with either in the same condition or with their symptoms suppressed by medication or completely jumbled through electroshock. Electroshock is very powerful, and so you could definitely see people with their personalities altered. But I remember seeing one girl. She came in very psychotic, thought she was a snake and other things. But she had something going on with her blood chemistry. When they tested her, her enzymes were just something like 100 times normal, one particular types of enzyme, and they were afraid to give her anything, any medication. So they just sort of let her, stay there. And she just sort of calmed down and got back to normal. She was actually a charming young woman. And she left very bubbly and that sort of thing, and she was okay. But that was the only time I had ever seen anybody recover, and I can only attribute it to the fact that she didn't get any treatment. I do recall seeing many other people leave there in a drugged stupor, or one particular woman I remember who had shock treatment. Calling it shock therapy is a bit of an oxymoron, I think. It's not quite therapy, but this woman was very, I remember asking her just before she left the hospital if she was ready to go home, and the mask of fear that came over her face, her eyes were darting about, and she was gave me this cold smile and said, oh yes, I'm ready to go home. And you could see there was just this fear that if she didn't say the right thing, she would be getting more treatment. Yeah, I would say just that one person is the only person I remember seeing actually get better in the entire time I was there.
And that was just because she didn't get any treatment.
Exactly, yeah. It's a remarkable thing about that because it's been found that people who don't get treatment tend to recover on their own. There's a fascinating study done in World War II of the very worst mental patients when the Germans, I think, were coming in France, and the hospital staff had to abandon a hospital. And they had to leave the very worst patients there who simply could not fend for themselves. And a follow-up study was done sometime later, and they found that about 37% of these worst of all patients had just integrated themselves back into the community, and nothing had been done for them. So it's definitely possible to recover with nothing at all at times, you know.
All right. Talk therapy is very popular, and yet many of us believe that the talk therapy, though it's non-toxic, may not be as beneficial as a lot of psychologists, psychotherapists, and analysts believe it to be. What are your views on talk therapy?
Well, I think we all have the human need to express our feelings, and especially when we're under great burdens, it always helps to have a friend or a minister or someone who's willing to listen to you when you have troubles. However, when people get into severe mental states, just talking alone, and from my observations and from the studies that I've seen, really isn't going to always crack what's wrong. the main thing is that people who get talk therapy are not really being looked at for other things. For example, a lot of people who are labeled with schizophrenia, these people could have wheat allergies or milk allergies. I just talked to a professor last week whose daughter had a severe wheat allergy, and she had gone psychotic at the age, I believe, of 14, and didn't know what was wrong until they found it was she was allergic to wheat. She got off the wheat and she was normal again. Well, that's not going to be handled by talking, you know. And Robert Cade, the doctor who invented Gatorade down in Florida, he found that people who have wheat or milk allergy, I think he found about a quarter of the people labeled with schizophrenia who he had studied, about a quarter of them had allergies to wheat or milk. And when they ate the wheat or milk, it actually converted into what's called an opiate. It's basically an opium product. And, of course, if you get that in your system, you're going to act pretty goofy. And, of course, something like that, that's not going to be resolved with talk therapy. So, those are the types of things that...
Dan, some of the standard psychiatric therapies and theories that they're based upon are that all patients are genetically predisposed to mental illness. What has your research shown on this?
Well, that is not necessarily true. I mean, it certainly is possible that people can be have a genetic predisposition to things that can affect the mind. For example, you can have a genetic predisposition to diabetes, and certainly people can get mentally disturbed by diabetes, or other perhaps metabolic problems. Some people have a greater need for zinc, or they can't handle copper as well. I suppose those things can affect your mind. And so I think science will probably show as time goes on that certain metabolic problems can lead to mental difficulties, you know, they've already shown that, but they will probably show that those types of metabolic problems may be inherited. But, you know, to say that just point blank that it's all inherited is pretty strange, you know. In Colorado, they did a study on thyroid, for example, and they found that about almost one in six people tested in a huge study of about 25,000 people, almost one in six had a thyroid problem, and that can affect your mind. And in fact, some people get severely suicidal if their thyroid is too low. And so to say that that's an inherited problem is really grossly oversimplifying things. Also, someone with a metabolic problem that may be inherited, if he eats properly, he will probably never even notice this. For some of your books give wonderful examples of dietary approaches that could completely avoid, where people could completely avoid this sort of thing. Another good example is with depression. Duke University found that that walking is and about a 30-minute brisk walk or jog three times a week will handle depression as effectively as antidepressants. So you could have two twins, one who walks regularly and the other one who doesn't. So the one who doesn't gets depressed, and the one who walks doesn't. So, I mean, you know, to say it's all genetic is really grossly oversimplifying. A great deal of it has to do with how we live our lives as well.
One other question, Dan. What patient rights, if they want to, what are the patient rights if they want to decline treatment or if they have been administered treatment against their will?
Boy, that's a tough one. It depends a great deal on the laws in the state that you are in. We happen to be in California, where patients have the right to refuse medication under almost all circumstances. And I don't think we've had much forced electroshock here. I understand you have quite a case going on in New York, which I'm very, very sad to see. I have to say, anybody who had, when you lose the right to have electricity run through your brain, to stop having electricity run through your brain, that's pretty hard to believe in this country. People do have a voice. Most states have a consumer, what's called a director of consumer affairs in the Department of Mental Health, and the people in those departments are willing to talk to them. So those things, they can also come on our website. We have a website, alternativementalhealth.com.
Okay, let's do that slowly. It's www.alternativementalhealth.com. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct, yeah. Okay. We have a directory of physicians across the country there who use nutritional treatments and that sort of thing instead of the standard drug therapies.
Good for you. Well, I wanted to introduce you and your organization to our audience today, and I want to thank you very much for being out there. And so people do have options when they're up against the choices that frequently are not in their best interest. Dan Stratford, thank you very much for being on. Let's go over now and say hello to our next guest. And she is Margot Kidder, and many people will remember and or know of her work. She has been an actress, appeared in 55 films, over 100 television programs. She's most noted for her role in Superman, and she's more recently become a spokesperson for alternative mental health treatment. Nice to have you on today.
Good to be on, Gary.
Did you find that you had any underlying health problems that were creating the symptoms of manic depression?
Oh, I, like probably most people who have the what's called manic depression, had so many things that were wrong with me physically, it was a joke. And because I'd been to so many shrinks and not one had ever asked after my health, it was a whole new world for me discovering that, in fact, physical problems cause mental symptoms. So it was very exciting once I started on this path.
When did you recognize that you were suffering from connection, the depression, and the association with something in your lifestyle?
Well, I unfortunately, like so many people, came to alternative medicine for help only as a desperate last act, as opposed to going to it first, which is how it should be, and hopefully someday soon will be. The last big public flip out was when I finally said, and I'd known somewhere all along, or certainly in the last few years before it, that this drug therapy wasn't working and just was simply making things worse, in my belief. And so I sat down with, after I'd come down with acupuncture and heard a bit about Dr. Hoffer and vitamin treatment, sat down with some conventional medical texts and my chemistry dictionary to look up the phrases, and really went to work and plowed through them and found that even in conventional research texts, you'll find references to various amino acid deficiencies, to vitamin deficiencies. And what's very odd about these conventional texts is instead of saying, well, go to the health food store and get the vitamin or the amino acid, they would then tell you what drug dealt with the symptoms of that deficiency. So in reading that, it was a glaringly obvious fault of logic there. And so I said to myself, well, hell, why don't I just go to the Whole Foods in L.A. or wherever and get myself some GABA, which is an amino acid that seems to be deficient in mania and depression, and get myself some tryptophan, which is the precursor to serotonin, serotonin being deficient in mania and depression. And it wasn't until about, gosh, 8-9 months later that I learned there were actually really wonderful doctors and researchers doing this work, and then I got a lot of help.
Do you feel the media sensationalized reports about your suffering from mental illness?
Well, I think they reflected the general public's attitude towards so-called mental illness, in that because the very, unfortunately, unpoetic and simple realities about the physical things that are wrong that underlie it are not public knowledge, it's still, in a way, seen as this mysterious, I won't say possessed by the devil, but we're not far from that. And so I think that the press really just reflected what people think about mental illness. Thus the taboo, you know, there's this big taboo about it. Nobody talks about it because nobody's properly explained it publicly.
You've researched alternative treatments for mental health extensively now, in particular the role, as you just mentioned, amino acids for manic depression or bipolar disorder. What have you found to be the most helpful supplements for a person suffering from manic depression?
Well, you know, that's tricky. The thing about alternative medicine or orthomolecular medicine, which is what I use, is that it's not, unlike what the pharmaceutical companies would have us believe, it's not a one-size-fits-all magic bullet shot for everybody who's got this label called manic depression. What manic depression or schizophrenia or ADD or any of these labels in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual are simply collections of symptoms. And if you have X number of symptoms out of a list of, and I'm making these numbers up, say 11, and if you have 6 or 7, you get the label on the top of the page, and of course they all bleed into each other. So all mental illness really is a symptom that something's wrong with the body. You can have 10 people with the diagnosis of manic depression, and they can have 10 different things wrong with them. So the job of the consumer, and that's a misnomer because often when you're in real trouble, you don't get to choose your form of treatment, needs to do their own homework and find out through testing, through the help of an orthomolecular doctor, what it is in their system that's gone awry, that needs to be fixed. A lot of the problems start in the gut with malabsorption of minerals or simply not eating, and vitamins and amino acids, simply not eating the right things, or an inability of the gut to absorb the nutrients from the food.
If you were to look at yourself today and how you feel and how your brain feels, how your perceptions are, as compared to when you were doing what the psychiatric community had suggested, what would be the primary difference?
Oh, gosh. When I was on the what I call the shrink drugs, I felt like pond scum. I just had no brain and was unable to think. Or when I'd been diagnosed with ADD and put on speed with an antidepressant and a downer for manic depression, I would be racing but confused, if that makes sense. There's a wonderful clarity now, and there's also the best thing, which is that I wake up every morning and I'm the same person. Now, that may not make sense to someone who hasn't suffered from mental symptoms of a physical disorder, but it really, one of the main things you can say about so-called mental illness is that you really are not sure when you wake up what's going to happen. Who's going to come out today, is how I put it. So the great joy for me is this consistency of thought and an ability to be in the moment and to not have my head spinning all the time. It still spins a bit, but not in the way that it did. The downers that they drug you with for manic depression are just hideous. And there's this myth that people go off, say, lithium because they miss the highs of mania. And the truth is you go off the lithium or Depakote or whatever you've been put on because you feel like hell.
Mm-hmm.
So the best part of it is being able to think, being able to concentrate. I'm certainly not perfect. I don't think I'm ever going to get to that one. But and it's an ongoing process. There's one thing I'd like to say to anyone who's listening, and it's really important that people understand this. There's not a line, a concrete line dividing the mentally ill from the mentally well. There's shades from black to white, all through the various shades of gray, white being absolute wellness. Now, I don't know anybody who's white, but I do know that we all live somewhere along that scale. And if you slip too far down towards the black, you're going to get mental symptoms that make you think you're crazy. You'll go to a shrink, you get a label, and then they give you the drugs that are pertinent to that label, or they think are.
What has happened as far as your career since then? Has Hollywood reevaluated how they approach someone who at one time they would have nothing more to do with?
Well, you know, that's a tricky one to answer. First of all, I'm a 52-year-old woman, and there are not a lot of parts there, so that's tricky. There are also a lot of people in my business who could be called a little off-center. I just did a Law and Order Special Victims Unit and was having lunch with the producer, and he said, "Now, I don't want to offend you, but people still ask me, how's she doing?" Which I suppose is a normal question, even though it's been 5 years. people are generally pretty supportive. What I discovered after all this happened publicly, it had happened before privately, there are so many millions and millions of people who go through versions of this who were dying to have someone to talk to. I got letters from all over the globe. And that was my first realization as to how common it was. So I think that there people are actually, by and large, very compassionate because most people have a family member or a good friend who's affected this way, or they themselves are.
Well, I certainly appreciate you coming forward to share your experience and to give hope to the people in this audience who are suffering and think that it's all in their head, there's nothing they can do. There are options.
Oh, there are so many options. It's probably not in your head. It's in your body. I mean, the brain is an organ of the body, and there's not a steel plate separating the brain from the rest of the system.
Do you have a web page for people to refer to?
Well, you know, I use alternativementalhealth.com, and there's a wonderful fellow, Bob Cole, who set up a Margot Kidder webpage, which I just got an email from him this morning that said, he said, I seem to have gotten into the mental health business. So there's stuff on there.
Okay. Very nice to speak with you.
Good to talk to you, too.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
That's Margot Kidder. Now, in the time remaining, I'd like to share some additional insights, especially on depression, since that's what she was talking about. I remember the time when I was brought to my attention, and generally when someone who is appreciated, sports figures who get injured, I must have had 500 emails and letters when Magic Johnson was diagnosed as HIV positive. In fact, his physician and manager did call me, and I did give them a protocol. And a lot of famous athletes have, mainly through the people who are their fans, who the athlete does know me, and the people say, gee, you know, if you want to overcome this knee problem or back problem, or some people sometimes have to retire because of the injuries. And a lot of times, not always, but a lot of times those injuries can be reversed. But when it's in something like a personality factor, it's a little harder for people to get a handle on. And especially if it's an addictive behavior like Robert Downey Jr. or Daryl Strawberry, I have had 1,000 emails and letters. Gary, can you help this person? Possibly. If I can communicate with him. And communicate with them. If you're a drug addict, it's easy to communicate with them. If you're on the south side of the, you know, south side of the street and a derelict, you can bump into them and spend a night with them. If you want to help them, that's the last thing they're looking for. They're making a choice. They're not looking for help. They're not picking up a telephone. They've decided they don't want that help because there have been a lot of people through a lot of centers who've tried to help. It's a choice. We'd like to say that it's all in their mind. It's an addiction. I don't believe that. In fact, one of the things that I've done quietly, haven't discussed it, is I've been working with people who've been hardcore addicts and trying not just to get them off the drugs, but get them off the 12-step programs, which may be heresy for a lot of people who consider that what saved their life. But I see too many people, not all, too many, who become as addicted to their 12-step programs, just another form of addiction, as they were to whatever the physical substance was. It's a dependency. It's not biochemical. It's emotional. And if I can, and I'm not sure I can, right now I'm trying. In fact, next week we're having a meeting with one of the hospitals to open up a holistic hospice to help people. But my next effort in trying to offer something I feel would be a constructive new paradigm would be a holistic detoxification for people with what are called addictive behavior, whether it's drugs or alcohol, smoking, overeating, compulsions, a live-in environment where you could go there and stay. A holistic Betty Ford, for want of a better concept, but it's far broader than a Betty Ford. And the entire approach would be different. Now, the good news is that with the exception of one person who never actually did the program, The other people who have done this program have stayed clean and most constructively are happy today. They're not angry. They're not looking for an excuse to turn back around and go back where they came from. They're going forward with their lives. And I wanted to have several years with a lot of people and have them followed and even their blood work up, because a lot of people who are into the drugs also have hepatitis, cytomegalovirus, and a lot of addictive behaviors end up with very serious physical disease. And in time, the liver goes, the kidneys go, they get upper respiratory tract infections, pneumocystis, all kinds of conditions. So the idea is to clean up everything, starting with attitude. And as that goes, so goes the body. And a completely different way, a non-toxic way of cleaning up from the addiction. And I've got it now where I can pretty much get someone off almost any addictive substance in under a week. I mean hardcore. Cocaine, heroin, smack. Smack's the hardest. Coffee, 3 days. Sugar addictions. And I say addictions in that it's a repeat behavior, not that it's a brain addiction, though it will affect behavior, and it can adversely affect normal serotonin uptake. So rebalancing the brain amino acids as this whole process. Anyhow, it's a rather extensive program, but that's one of my one of the projects. It's a long-term project. May not happen for, I don't know, a year or longer, but one day in the future, there will be a day when you'll hear me say, it's here. And then people, infamous and famous and obscure, will at least have a place that if they choose to, they can do a comprehensive change, cleanse, from any previous so-called addictive habit. Right now, we're just trying to keep people alive with the first holistic hospice in the United States. Right now, virtually every single human being that goes into a hospice dies, no exceptions. The average is under 3 months. And I've been made a couple offers. I've turned them down because they weren't willing to be a holistic. You know, and the protocols were so minimal that it wouldn't have made a difference, and therefore it would have been set up to fail. I've held out to where they're going to let me do it all. Everything that I want to do to impact upon a person who's dying, to show them we can reverse this. And that's what you have to do. You have to show. You have to have hard data. And this is being set up, hard data. Everything about that, beginning to end, medical records, everything. And with 30 people. So I'll let you know when it happens, when it's completed. Nothing will be known before then, because I don't want the political opponents, and I've got a bunch. You have no idea how many times my computer has now been hacked into, my personal office. Someone got into it last week and stole some stuff. Coincidentally, my security system was turned off for that period of time. You have no idea what it's like, the nonsense I have to go through. So unfortunately, some of the things I'd like to say over the air about some of the good things happening, I can only say it after it's happened, so that people who would like to interfere with it can't. But that's something that's going to be done. So we will have a holistic hospice, and we will have a holistic place for people to go to. And I do have completed, in presenting on the 9th of next month, before a state's complete health committee, a holistic nursing home protocol that has already been gone through 2 years of review with all the scientific documentation. And it looks like, hopefully, they will give it the green light to be tried in 20 nursing homes, and then compare the data over 1 year of cross-matching people in 20 nursing homes where the protocols are used versus 20 nursing homes where the protocols are not used, in the severity and extent of the different dementias. Because on a personal level, I've helped an awful lot of people who've had dementia, and that's a big one, because there's nothing worse than seeing your parents and loved ones just lose their cognition and no longer are able to function, don't know who you are. Physically, they can do all right, but they've lost it on other levels. So anyhow, all that's coming our way, and just takes time. But in the interim, we have a lot of other things that we're doing that take time also. Now, just let me get to one of those. We're going to have a demonstration, and I really hope that those of you who care about social change, who have not yet addressed with any consistency and possibly ever trying to make the rules bend for the people, put a law out there that really protects all of our rights against forced electroconvulsive therapy and neuroleptics, which are extremely dangerous. The demonstration will be at noon, May 21st, at the Attorney General Spritzer's headquarters, 120 Broadway in Manhattan. I'll have some psychiatrists, lawyers, activists, psychologists, former Office of Mental Health employees, and a lot of concerned persons there to challenge electroconvulsive therapy, neuroleptics, and I'll be presenting a major white paper at that time with all of the scientific documentation that will be used to affect, hopefully, law to be changed. They want proof. I prepared the proof. So it's the 21st of May at noon, and hopefully we'll be able to broadcast it live. I don't know that that's possible yet. We're working on it. And finally, yesterday I did some interview, and I've come up with a holistic mental health MD. Good for them. Never heard this. Some of the best people you've never heard of before, and I'm finding some really good people, and a holistic obstetrician and gynecologist. So we're getting some good people lined up to help people. And there is a new Metropolitan Wellness Group at 31 East 28th Street that's there to help people with Epstein-Barr and herpes and cancer and heart disease, depression, anxiety, obesity, nutritional issues. Whatever the problem, someone's there who can help. Let me give you a number, 212-252-1942. You all have a nice day. Tomorrow, conclusion of the ongoing investigative report on toxic teeth, part 3. And then Friday, got a very interesting expose program for you. Have a nice day, everyone.